You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
And views expressed on this program are the responsibility of those who make them. They do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates.
Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are and wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. Be sure you go over to kevinsmithshow.com and check out what is there. A couple of things you might want to check out. One for sure, you want to click on that red link that says subscribe free to the K-Files e-zine. Now, that is our free weekly newsletter. No strings attached. It's truly free. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. So be sure you subscribe to that, though, because it's always got good information and interesting links. And as I said, it's free. Now, one of our listeners, he's been a listener for quite some time, and I hear from him rather frequently in the UK, sent me an email today, and it is an account of his viewing, seeing a UFO. Now, this event happened, this incident happened in London, East London, and it was just a few hours ago. And he, one of the things that the whole account is very interesting, but one of the things I thought was really interesting and very important for people to think about, he says, and I'm quoting, "There were planes in the sky which were very visible and very unlike the object that was now passing over our heads. There were no other colored lights associated with the object. It seemed lower than the other planes in the sky, and it seemed to be traveling at a rather slow speed." Now, you may be asking yourself, well, why is that important? Well, it's important because one of the key tools that professional debunkers use is to say, well, you know, it was probably this plane or that plane, and they mistook it, and, you know, they're not trained observers, and, you know, well, look. Here in the United States of America, over many sporting events, we have something called the Goodyear blimp. And, it's one of those big dirigible types, you know, has helium in it. And it floats around up there. And when you look at it, whether you are a trained observer or not, you can see that it is different from all the other airplanes you see flying over the stadium. You see other airplanes fly over the stadium. They have wings. The Goodyear blimp does not. They are shaped like airplanes, and the Goodyear blimp is not. When you look into the sky and you see two objects, A and B, and you can differentiate between those two, you do not have to be a so-called trained observer. Of course, professional debunkers certainly have a problem when the observer happens to be a pilot, and then they've got to come up with some other kind of nonsense. But this has been going on down in Stephenville, Texas, with the the debunkers trying to do stuff to make it to obscure the story in Texas. People on the ground know what they're looking at, even if they can't really identify what that craft is. They know it's not another airplane. We'll be back with Charles Hall right after this. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles and free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to alienseekernews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today. Okay, folks, this is what you've been waiting for, your vacation of a lifetime. It awaits your arrival down under in beautiful and historic Hobart, Tasmania. And to make sure your holiday really is a dream come true, you'll be staying at the Bath Street Apartments. Here are just a few of the things that you'll enjoy in your home for the holidays. Stunning water and mountain views from all windows and from your own private balcony or veranda. Modern furnishings, a full modern kitchen with all new appliances, oven and hot plates, fat-free grill, full-size refrigerator, large-capacity microwave oven, cappuccino machine, dishwasher, and enough crockery, cutlery, and utensils to satisfy anyone's culinary desires. The lounge room has an extensive range of electronic home entertainment equipment, including, now get this, a big-screen TV, free digital satellite, pay TV on Foxtel AllStar with over 60 channels, DVD, video, wireless broadband connection, free local telephone calls from the in-room telephone with your own private telephone number so loved ones and friends can call you directly. The bathroom? Wow, the bathroom has a large spa bath, separate shower cubicle, ceiling-mounted heat lamp and fan and hair dryer, and it just gets better and better. Folks, you've got to see Bath Street Apartments, so click the banner over on the Kevin Smith Show website or just go to bathstreetapartments.com.au. Your dreams are awaiting your arrival. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. I'll be there in the morning light. My guest this evening has been with us before. You are, if you have been listening to this show for any amount of time, familiar with the name Charles Hall. And you have no doubt heard him on many other radio shows. Charles Hall is the man who revealed to the world the existence of an extraterrestrial base located at Indian Springs, or near Indian Springs. And he came to know about that because he was in the Air Force and was stationed there, and he came into contact with and got to know some of these extraterrestrials that he calls the Tall Whites. There are things about Charles Hall that you may not know that you should know. And I hope tonight we will be able to reveal some of those things to you. We've mentioned them before, but I hope that tonight we'll be able to delve into some of those things a little more than we have in previous shows. And he's got a new book out, Millennial Hospitality 4. On my website, right beside his picture, is a link to his website with information about all four of his books. The first three were novels. The fourth one is not. And Charles, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be back. My first, everything in all four of my books, including the first three, is true and happened to me. And the first three books, because I discuss the experiences that I had that also involved other men stationed with me, it was necessary for me to change their names and to write it in a, you know, because I wanted to protect the innocent and I didn't want to upset the Air Force. But everything in all four books is true and happened to me.
But in book number four, the gloves come off, so to speak, and you use the real names of the locations, and you have added some things in the fourth book that we didn't hear about in the first three.
That's correct, yes.
And I want us to get into some of that tonight. First, I want to talk about Charles Hall just a little bit.
Sure.
Because I think it's important for people to have a sort of a sense of who you are. And the reason that's important is because sometimes, you know, right now we've got this big flap going on in Texas with the big UFO sighting there. And one of the things that the professional debunkers do is they always say, well, these are not, you know, experienced or trained observers and so forth. And I think it's important for people to understand that although I may not be an astronaut, I am not an idiot. And although I have met, I have run into an idiot or two amongst the astronaut corps, but and I say that when I say one or two, I mean just one or two. They're generally speaking really sharp, really switched on people. But here's the deal. People need to know that, first of all, you are a bona fide computer expert.
Yes, that's correct. As you see, I have two master's degrees. I have a master's degree in nuclear physics, and I also have an MBA. And if I ever completed my thesis work, I started work on three different PhDs, but I never completed them. And and although in the Air Force I did not yet have a college education, I only had a year and a half of college when I went into the Air Force, so I was an enlisted man in the U.S. Air Force. Currently, I have a very high government clearance, and I'm a database expert, and I'm an expert in all the different types of computers. I know all the different types of databases, including Oracle and SQL Server, and many databases that aren't around anymore. And I also know all the computer languages, you know, from Java and C++ and Fortran and all those things. I've been doing that for more than 30 years. Among the things that I've done over the course of my career is I've done lots of computer work that relates to nuclear weapons and to subatomic particles and work in that area as well. So I'm well versed in nuclear physics, where my degree is in, as well as being an expert in computers themselves.
Well, there are a couple of things in your resume that really caught my eye, and I've read your resume before. It never caught my eye before. But each time I read it, I find more stuff in it. First of all, with the Department of Energy, you have had a security clearance of a Q clearance.
That's correct, yes.
What is that?
Well, it's the equivalent of a top secret. It's the different agencies have different names for their different clearances, but they all generally conform to the sequence of having a low-level clearance is confidential, then a higher level is secret, then top secret, and then above top secret. And usually you have to have like a top secret clearance to be told what the next series of clearances are above you. One of the really high ones that I always thought was really humorous was the one entitled Burn Before Reading. So when you make a really high-level document, you're supposed to mark it Burn Before Reading, and then if anyone sees it, they're supposed to just burn it and not read it. And then above that is a still higher one, which is Hide in Plain Sight. And so some very highly classified things or very top secret things that can't be hidden, you know, or that is to say, have to exist out in plain sight. And so, to be told what the actual secret is as opposed to the cover story, that's like an extremely high clearance. An example of such a project might be, I'm only referring to publicly available information that's printed in the, like on the front page of the New York Times and available to the general public, but you know, in this discussion, but for example, the so-called radar station that the U.S. military is building on the westernmost island in the Aleutian chain, which has a publicly announced price tag of something in the vicinity of $70 billion and rising. You know, we note that that would be that's a digital facility because all radars are digital these days. And we note that when that radar is pointed straight up from the latitude that it's at, that it will be beaming signals directly towards Barnard's star, the fourth closest star, and also beaming it towards that island, that chain of nearby stars that form like an island chain, the fourth, fifth, and sixth closest stars. And you'll see in my book, in my third book, and also in my fourth book, I refer to the Norwegians with 24 teeth. And the three Norwegians that I met who were genetically coded for 24 teeth, when I call them the Norwegians with 24 teeth because they look just like Norwegian people from Norway, but they're not really. They're from a Earth-like planet orbiting one of those stars, the fourth or fifth closest star. And we note that radar station, when beaming straight up, is beaming signals directly towards that star. And that would be an example of the kind of project that the U.S. military engages in, which, in effect, is being hidden right out in plain sight.
Yeah, well, you know, it's surely someone would see it, would note it, would Google Earth and do Google Earth and get a photo of it. So they have to kind of hide it in plain sight.
Yeah. Another such project is the recently announced NASA project to beam digital signals that contain music towards Polaris, the North Star. Now, Polaris itself is 431 light years away, and so if you're beaming a signal towards Polaris, it's not going to get there for 431 years. And so, you know, the motivation would kind of escape a person. Polaris itself is really three stars. It's a huge supergiant that's very bright. That's the one we actually see. But then there's two other very small stars in the cluster, and the motivation for actually sending anything to Polaris at that distance, like the music and stuff, you know, would certainly be comical. But we note that because the transmission of that signal when you send it out into space is that when you're pointing your antenna straight up and broadcasting, that just like that radar station in the Aleutians, you're broadcasting towards Barnard's star and towards that island chain of stars. And we note that if you're sending a digital signal, that, you know, the Barnard star is only like five and a half light years away, and if a ship is coming towards Earth from that star, you're simply sending them a beacon, a beam rider, that they can stay, you know, to so that they can stay, that they can head towards. And if that ship is already halfway here, just speaking hypothetically, say like 2.5 light years away, that means that it'll reach the signal coming out from Earth that you transmitted just like a year or so prior, which isn't long at all. And with today's technology, those aren't, those distances aren't, our current technology is well within those kind of ranges. And but because this, because you'd be sending a broadband signal, you would also have, and you'd be sending it digitally, you'd also have to send reference marks so that the person receiving the signal would be able, you know, if there was like static or magnetic storms or star solar flares that would disrupt portions of the signal, so the receiver can resync up with the transmitter. Now, that kind of stuff is done all the time in military radars by all the nations in the world, not just the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese. That's how military radars are all built, to have reference signals. So you're sending a digital packet that's the reference signal, then you're sending the packet that has the information, and then you're sending, and you may send several of those, then you're sending a reference mark again. Well, of course, to send a reference mark, it has to be something where each reference mark is unique, and therefore, if you're sending it over those kinds of distances, you, the most obvious reference mark is some song that when the person hears it, you know, if they start playing the signal through an audio receiver, they'll immediately know where they are in the transmission sequence, you see? Uh-huh. And see, and so that would be another project where I would ask NASA the question, you know, are you really sending music to Polaris, or is that just the cover story? You know,
yeah.
when people talk about disclosure and getting the government to disclose what it knows, they have a very from my point of view as a physicist, they need to take a broader view of what disclosure would actually be, you know, what would be actually be involved in disclosure. Many people that I've come across seem to think that disclosure would consist of the U.S. government talking about lights that may have appeared in the sky in 1954, but really disclosure would have a, you know, you'd be talking a lot more about politics and social things, you know, and physical things. Those lights in Texas, for example, if a person convinces themselves that even one of those lights is a real object that is accelerating and changing direction at very, very high speed, then that means that whoever is on board that object is using physically real or real principles that are, that weren't known to Einstein. And so really a person when studying those lights, in my humble opinion, wouldn't just be looking for light patterns or whatever, they would be looking for proof that there were more force fields, more to physics than what Einstein knew about. And you can see it immediately when the lights, if you pick an object that you, a light that you feel is a real solid object, and if it's changing direction suddenly, then it must be surrounded by another force field.
Well, this was one of the big arguments that formed the debate between Einstein and Niels Bohr.
Yes, uh-huh.
Because Bohr said that there were other forces and uh-huh. that other equations had to be considered. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And this was one of the... And, you know, they actually met... Right. Yeah. I think it was Einstein that went to Niels Bohr to his home and spent a few days, and they really got after it and really did what geniuses do, I guess, and debated each other yeah. personally. But that's uh-huh. what they were talking about.
Uh-huh. In Book 3, in the appendix of Book 3 of Millennial Hospitality 3 and in Millennial Hospitality 4, I've included more information on the physical theory I call Hall photon theory, and Hall photon theory says that there are more says that there are more force fields in for real in nature and therefore more ways that energy can be stored and released and transformed and converted than what Einstein knew about. And therefore, Einstein's relativity is not correct. And Hall photon theory says that there must be more quarks, those subatomic particles that form the basis of quark theory, that there have to be more than just five or six quarks, that there has to be at least one quark for every different force field, so there has to be at least like eight or nine, maybe more, quarks for each one responsible for a different force field, and therefore there has to be more variation in the subatomic particles and in light itself than what Einstein was aware of. And once you take those into account, then relativity is simply not correct. For example, Einstein's theory that in relativity, his twin paradox, the theory that if a vehicle is in motion, that time slows down for that vehicle when it's being as compared with a stationary observer. So Einstein's twin paradox is, when you think about it, has to be laughably wrong, because if the time slowdown were correct, it would mean that one high-speed particle in a particle accelerator could never actually collide with a stationary particle, because according to Einstein, those two particles are running in different time frames. But in fact, of course, particles bump into each other all the time in high speed, in particle accelerators and the Hadron Collider and cloud chambers and that, proving that all of those particles, even when they're moving, are in the same frame of time. Time is moving the same for all those particles. When I was working on computer codes and computing nuclear-related things, one of the things that was very common for me to do was to, when you're making up the input decks for computers, for that compute nuclear reactions and stuff, was to study the cross-section libraries very carefully. What's the cross-section for, a high-speed electron striking on a stationary proton, Well, those cross-section libraries, are directly measured in particle accelerators, and, time can't possibly be the two particles couldn't possibly be in different time frames when they, otherwise they'd never collide.
They could not meet.
Yeah. Einstein always concealed that, because he always said, what if one twin were here on the Earth, and then what if another twin got in a rocket ship and went far away and went around the sun real fast, and then, and then came back, and then the twin on Earth would be an old man, and the twin on Earth would be a young man. And then all of us young, when we were young and we were in college, then the mere thought of us as old men would shock us, and then they'd never actually sit down and think about it. But see, when you consider like a particle accelerator, the target that's stationary to the observer, that's in the same time frame as the observer. Well, the parts, there is something physical, a magnetic field or something material or something connecting, or a magnetic field or something, there's something physically real connecting that target with the moving particle, even if it's their electric fields or their magnetic fields. And therefore, they all have to be in the same frame. The time has to be moving the same for all of those particles, and there goes relativity with the time slowdown.
Charles, I hate to interrupt you because this is fascinating, but we are up against a break, and I don't want to get into this next little bit of information before the break because we need some time for you to talk about this. But one of the things that you worked on has been health physics analysis and radiation shielding studies, and I want to talk with you about that and space travel when we come back from this break. We're talking with Charles Hall. Charles Hall is a physicist. He is a scientist. He is a bona fide computer expert, and he knows some stuff. He's seen some stuff, but he knows some stuff as well.
And I want to ask you about these two things I see in your resume here. By the way, I also see that one of the computer systems that you're familiar with and have worked with is the Cray computer system. And, you know, there are very few people on the planet that can lay claim to that.
Thank you. But yes, that was one of my happier days when I was young and I could run without getting tired.
All right, let's talk about what I see here about radiation shielding studies. You've done that, and also health physics analyses.
Yes, I did that for more. That's one of the areas that my degree covers, and I have almost 30 years' experience in that area. Yeah.
Well, those two areas.
Mm-hmm. Or in those areas, yeah.
Yeah, they have, or could have, specific application to space travel.
That's correct, yeah.
Now, we're talking about the possibility, not too far into the future, of sending humans over to Mars.
That's correct, yeah.
Now, one of the problems that has to be solved is how to shield them from radiation.
You're perfectly correct on that. And the tall whites, see, when I was in, as I describe in my books, Millennial Hospitality, I got to see the tall whites, I got to see their deep space craft, the large titanium black craft, as well as their scout craft, the white craft. The scout craft, they were built using the same technology. The scout craft were built here on Earth using parts provided to them by the U.S. Air Force. The deep space craft, the titanium black craft, they were typically the size of like a cruise liner, the one that you might say if you were cruising the Caribbean, you know, you might take a cruise on a ship that size. And they were both craft, and I'll just talk about the deep space craft. They had a double hull construction, and they were ellipsoidal, and that is to say they were streamlined for very high speed flight. And both of those craft could easily travel faster than the speed of light. But as they were powering up, in between those two hulls, like in the case of the scout craft, there was like a 1,000 miles of fiber optic windings. And in the deep space craft, there was correspondingly more. And one of those sets of windings, when they powered it up, would generate a force field around that craft that was not electric, it was not magnetic, it was a different kind of field that protected the occupants from radiation as well as protecting the occupants from the forces of inertia and the forces of acceleration. And when those craft powered up that outer set of windings, when you'd see them out in the desert, if that outer set of windings were turned off, then you could actually see the hull the way you would if you saw an airplane in the distance. But when they powered it up, it would fuzz over because it would interact with light, proving that light has to have a third field inside each photon of light. And that protected the occupants from the radiation, the cosmic radiation and so on that you encounter in space. If you didn't have radiation protection and you were out traveling in space, even a short distance, like from here to Mars, you know, it'd be like trying to spend some time inside a microwave oven. I mean, you have some of those cosmic rays are coming in, you know, with extremely high frequencies. And, you know, if you were in space for even a short time, traveling out between the stars and stuff, and being exposed to all that radiation. Well, their bodies were made out of carbon. Their bodies were just like ours. They couldn't take that radiation any more than we could. So that that protective field that protected them from both radiation and the forces of inertia, that was one of the key elements of their design.
Anytime I see any sort of a documentary that has to do with our space program and going to Mars or anything like that, I'm interested and I watch it. One of them that I've seen recently talks about this problem, and they talk about various solutions to the problem, and one of the solutions... And I thought about you, because we've talked about this just briefly, you and I personally.
Yeah.
But I thought about you when I saw this. One of the possible solutions, they said, would be to generate some type of a force field around the spacecraft and block radiation that way. Now, without that... And people really should get this in their minds. It's pretty much, with all of its sophistication, any spacecraft we build and send to Mars is going to be pretty much, as you said, it'd be kind of like being inside a beer can sitting in a microwave.
That's correct, yeah. Because, you have the Van Allen radiation fields around the Earth. You have solar flares coming off of the sun. You have, there's no protective magnetic field around Mars. You're sitting out there exposed to the full spectrum of radiation coming from the sun, as well as cosmic radiation. Some of those cosmic particles are coming in at 90% the speed of light. Some of those are very high energy particles and have come like from halfway across the galaxy or have come from the galactic center. When you have magnetic storms in the sun, you're putting out particles. But in addition, the sun itself, just because it's hot and radiates, is putting out microwave and other radiation that would normally be that is normally shielded from us by our ionosphere here on Earth. But when you go out in space, you're getting it all, and it's coming in everywhere. It's coming in through the glass windows on your spacecraft. It's coming in, from all sorts of places.
Well, unless you have some kind of shield, it's coming in through the skin, through the body of the spacecraft.
Yeah, and see if you were to try to shield that so that the people on board this spacecraft weren't, had some kind of shielding to protect them. Well, one of the problems you have is that, like, high-speed electrons going into, say, lead, as they're slowing down, are going to convert the radiation from high-speed electrons into bremsstrahlung, into high-speed in microwave and other gamma rays and other kinds of radiation. So, if you're just talking about trying to shield all that to create a safe area inside the spacecraft, if you were trying to do it by ordinary techniques, the first problem you have is the weight of the shield, which can be really heavy, and then the fact that the shield may not be very good against very high-speed particles.
Then you also have the problem that you're sitting inside of a spacecraft that's surrounded by an ever more contaminated shield.
That's correct. And see, if you were to try to surround your spacecraft, let's say you were to try to do it with an electric field. Well, right there, for an ordinary spacecraft with sharp edges, it's going to bleed off the electrons and everything. It's going to bleed off that field. And if you try with a magnetic field, you're going to have similar problems. And the people on board, you're going to have real questions about how the human brain reacts to being immersed inside magnetic fields or electric fields. But see, the tall whites, the field that they were using to protect the occupants from was not electric and it was not magnetic. It was a different kind of force field. And that's why I say there have to be more force fields in nature than what Einstein knew about. And the Hall photon theory says that the field they were using was the third field that is inside a photon, and it's associated with electric and magnetic fields. but it is not itself an electric or a magnetic field. So that you could be in the field, as I describe in the chapter entitled The Rabbit Test, where I speak from direct experience, where me and the rabbit could be inside the field, and nothing electrical, like the truck wouldn't work, the generator wouldn't work, but because the field was strong enough, there was a range in there where it was strong enough to keep, to provide protection, but it wasn't, but you know, as a human, you were still able to just walk around and be yourself, you see.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't feel like any tingling or anything like that?
Not inside that field, no.
You know, very closely related to the radiation shielding situation would be the health physics and analysis of health physics, because we have to know something about what all of these fields can do to humans. Now, let's assume for a moment, we have a break coming up, but let's assume for a moment that the Tall Whites have shared that technology and that we now know how to do this radiation shielding. Let's assume, this is purely speculation, not even that, hypothetical. It's hypothetical. Assuming that they've shared that technology... It's cool for them, but what does it do to a human body? Now, that has to be worked on and determined to make sure that humans react and respond inside that shield over a long period of time in the same way that the Tall Whites would. I want to talk about that when we come back. Folks, we'll be back with Charles Hall right after this.
Made for me.
Did you know the Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcasts right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith Shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download. Welcome back. Let me remind you very quickly, if you have not yet done so, go over to kevinsmithshow.com and subscribe to our free weekly newsletter. All right? Takes about 10 seconds, that's all. And by the way, you won't be spammed as a result of subscribing, because we don't give, rent, lease, lend, or sell our email list to anybody. All right? It's just ours. So when you subscribe, you'll be getting a weekly email from us. One. All right? My guest is Charles Hall, and we're talking about things that are attendant, concomitant with space travel. Charles, when we went away, I said that this whole thing about radiation shielding, once you get that solved, you still have to do tests to determine the health impact upon humans residing inside the shield.
Yes, you're correct. Now, in my books, by the way, in the Millennial Hospitality series, everything in those books is true and happened to me, and that includes the physics, that includes the physical observations and so on. The days when I was sitting, out at Range 3, and I was watching the scout craft come to, you know, power up and power down. The days that I was on board, and so on, and so so everything in those, in all four books, is physically correct. And I tried to write them in a way that was easy reading and also entertaining for the reader. And I also tried my goal was to share my emotions with the reader so that the reader could, you know, when I was actually experiencing those things, the emotion I felt, I wanted the reader to feel, or I was hoping the reader could feel. Of course, the first 6 months, I was typically very afraid. So, you know, the fear, the emotion I'm trying to share in the first 6 months is one of tremendous fear. But like, for example, the day in 1966, the day that one of the days that I was on board the scout craft, I noticed that they had taken a microwave oven, which, because all of the parts of the craft had been given them by the U.S. Air Force, and they had taken off the metal door, and they had instead extended the case, and instead of a metal door, they had wrapped fiber optic windings around the metal case at the front of it. And then they powered up that case so that there was a field performing the same function as the metal door does on a microwave oven. So when they turned on the microwave oven to heat their food, the microwaves didn't escape into the room because there was a field there which was physically forming a barrier. And from that I concluded that their bodies genetically functioned very similar to ours.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Now, you actually became familiar with, and we might even say friendly with, one of the tall whites that you refer to as the doctor.
The teacher. Yeah,
okay.
Now the doctor that I also describe, you know, he considered me to be a friend too, but I found him pretty intimidating because he was physically kind of large, you know.
Did you get any indication from him about their physiology?
Well, I note that the night the tour guide collapsed and they came out with the doctor and their nurses came out with the Scoutcraft version of the ambulance, I note that they laid the tour guide down flat on his back the same way we would have laid a human down, and that they were using off-the-shelf equipment that the U.S. Army uses on for battlefield to handle wounded soldiers in the battlefield, you know, like a stand to put in that glucose or that white, I guess it's glucose, you know, that
the intravenous.
Yeah, when they want to put fluid into your veins, that white stuff that they do an intravenous thing. Well, they laid him down, and they took out equipment given them by the U.S. Air Force, or, you know, that had been provided to him by the U.S. government, and they put it on a stand, and they were giving him an intravenous thing with glucose or that white fluid. I don't know what was actually in the fluid, but it certainly appeared to be straight off the shelf, you know.
Uh-huh.
They weren't, you know, they were doing to him exactly what you would have expected a field medical unit to do if a soldier had collapsed from having, like, a bad case of the flu or,
Well, now, you said that these people lived to be, like, 700 years old, right?
That's correct, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Just within the last couple of days, I think it was yesterday, as a matter of fact, that I read on the show an article, or referred to it, that has come out where some researchers in genetics have discovered they're only using the organism yeast.
Yeah.
Okay. But they have discovered how to make a small genetic change in it, and it will live 10 times longer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the article said, well, you know, I don't think we're going to be seeing people live to 800 just yet, but living to 120 should be easy.
Yes, and remember the Norwegians with 24 teeth, who I believe are coming here from either Bernard's star or the next star out, the fourth or fifth closest star, he told me that their life expectancy was twice that of humans, that they had a life expectancy of 140 years. And I characterize them with the term the Norwegians with 24 teeth. Now, I note on that topic of fields and radiation that the only physical difference I could see between him and his girlfriend and ordinary humans was just the genetic coding for the teeth, that he had 24 and we are genetically coded for 32. And that if you pulled out one of his molars, that another one would grow in, because the roots on his teeth were only about half as long as the roots on our teeth. But otherwise, he was genetically indistinguishable from humans. If my dentist hadn't pointed him out to me, I would have never guessed he was from another planet. And I note that that his description of how they came here from their home planet, which he said was almost the same size as the Earth and was half iced over, he said that it took them 20 years. I note that if you accelerate from, if you start from a planet orbiting a star at 6.5 light years, the way the fifth closest star is, the one just beyond Bernard's star, if you accelerate at 9 times the force of gravity for 10 years, that you'll reach something like 60% of the speed of light. You still haven't violated anything that Einstein said. And then if you follow this procedure that he described, he said they accelerated for 10 years, and then they turned the ship around and decelerated for 10 years, because the propulsion system initially was in the back, and if you accelerate at 9 G's for 10 years, and then if you decelerate at 9 G's for 10 years, that you'll make that crossing from a star 6.5 light years out. You'll travel from there to here to Earth in about 20 years. But that raises the question, 9 G's, the human body can't take 9 G's of acceleration for that long. The human body is hard-pressed to take even 2 G's for very long. and see his body was the same as ours. And when I asked him about what it was like on board, he said that they had surrounded their ship with a field, and which protected them from radiation as well as from allowed them to adjust gravity, so that when they were on board the spacecraft, the gravity on board the spacecraft was the same as it was on their planet, which also happens to be the same as it is here on Earth because the planets are the same size. So, and, you know, when you were saying, well, gee, where could the U.S. Air Force or where could NASA have decided that it would be possible to build a spacecraft and surround it with a force field, it wouldn't have to be the tall whites. It could easily be the Norwegians with 24 teeth, because he said his people were quite willing to work with the U.S. government, because their spacecraft, usually when they arrived here on the Earth, were fairly worn out, and only half the time could they be repaired and refurbished to return home.
All right, we have to take a break, and when we come back on the other side of this break, folks, I'm going to open the telephone lines for you. 1-800-289-1092 if you have a question or comment for Charles Hall.
Woke up this morning, had a strong desire to get this out. Never had the struggle to understand just what life's about. When I hold my six-string, I close my eyes, and I'm torn. Just have to figure out the secrets of the magic door. I'm tough, so I hug, and I puff, and I'm smooth, so I smile, and I grin, and I just want to find someone to let me in. Watch the world crawling slowly by. Every shadow, every blade of grass is a symphony in my mind's eye. So I scroll and I crawl and I crawl. I'm a twin, so I pray and I sin. And I just want to find someone to let me in. I believe in the magic finger. I believe.
Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We are glad you're here, and you will be too. We're talking with Charles Hall. He is the man that broke the story about an extraterrestrial base at Indian Springs, or near Indian Springs, and his contact with those extraterrestrials while he was stationed there in the Air Force many years ago. But we're getting a little deeper this time than we did previously. Before we talked about the story, which is fascinating in itself, absolutely fascinating. But we're getting a little deeper into this, and I want folks to realize that you really do have the background to know what you're talking about here. And that's why we jumped off into this, starting with your resume, because you are a physicist, and you are also a bona fide computer expert. Charles, when, you know, we were talking about their physiology.
Yes, uh-huh.
And you said that they seem to be pretty much just like us. How would you account for the fact that they are so tall, then? Here's what I'm getting at. They're very much like us, yet there are some differences. And I wonder if those small differences could make a big difference in how we react inside of that force field over a long period of time.
My own personal feeling is that from a physiology point of view, the way our bodies react to the force field is no different than the way their bodies do. For just purely from a physical point of view, because when you are standing there looking at them, throughout much of their, in the case of the tall whites, throughout much of their adult life, they're about the same height as I am, which is 5'11", 6 feet tall. The way they achieve the longer life is that when they become, is that their metabolism, you know, like the rate at which they grow and the rate at which their body repairs itself if they're injured, it takes them 10 times longer than it does us. So like one day, one morning when I was out there, I scratched myself and it drew a little blood, and I was young and I healed up quickly, and it wasn't much of a scratch, but the tall whites had seen that. Later in the afternoon, I wasn't wearing a bandage or anything. I was already healed up, and they were very impressed, as I've described in, you know, on previous radio shows. Well, see, from there, they take 10 times longer to heal up, and so they naturally live 10 times longer just because some parts of their physiology are running slower. Now, in addition, they age differently than we do. When we get to be like 39 or 40, then our body kind of stops repairing itself, if you will, and we start showing, you know, the effects of aging. But the tall whites, when they reach that same equivalent age, they don't, instead of aging like we do, they undergo a growth phase. So although they typically are 6 feet tall, give or take a little bit, throughout most of their adult life, when they get to be like 39 or 40, they start growing again.
Mm-hmm. The equivalent of our 39 or 40, when they hit middle age for them.
That's correct.
So that's about 350.
That's correct, yes. And then and that happens several times. So you see, when you're out in the desert, when you were talking to like to the older ones, like tour guide who was a little past middle age, well, he was like 6'5", 6'6", you know, 6 feet five, 6'6", 6 feet tall. By the time they get to be 700 or 800 years old, they are more than 8.5, 9 feet tall. They might even, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if they were even taller than 9 feet. One night when I was out at range 3, I noted one of the older ones who was unusually heavy set for them, but he would have looked more like an ordinary human. He was standing guard, and he was standing next to the control tower, which was wood, totally made out of wood, at range 3. And I noted where the top of his head was even with one of the cross beams. And then later in the day, I went out there and I measured it, and he was 8.5 feet tall. And see, he would have been equivalent to like 500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And see, so instead of aging, you might say their physiology uses the growth hormone to counteract the effects of aging. I note that studies in mice suggest that would work for humans too, because our physiology is so much the same. But of course,
yeah. But you know the problem with that.
Yeah.
Some government agency would make it illegal. It probably already is illegal to use human growth hormone without very, very strict rules and so forth.
Yeah.
Let's go to the telephone. Caller, sure. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, good evening, Kevin. This is Gary from New York.
Yes, Gary.
Good evening, Charles.
Good evening. It's nice talking with you.
It's nice to speak to you again. I talked to you the last time you were on Kevin's show.
I have a
question for you. Since your military days, have you been or are you still in contact with either one of these races that you're talking about? And I'll hang up and listen for the answer.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Okay. That's a very good question. The answer is not that I'm aware of, but because, like the Norwegians with 24 teeth are indistinguishable from ordinary humans, sometimes you're talking to people and, you know, I'm not a dentist, so, you know, I talk to a lot of people and they don't count their teeth, you know. So, maybe they've come up and talked with me and I don't know it because I'm not a dentist. Incidentally, I note, that this coming April 18th, that I will be doing a book signing on the East Coast at Mays Landing, New Jersey, which is outside Atlantic City, at the Borders Express. I'll be there in the evening, and it's on Black Horse Pike Road in Mays Landing, New Jersey, and of course, any of your listeners that happen to be in the area, that wish to stop by and talk with me in person, I'm always happy to talk with everyone. In the case of the tall whites, the young adults, the ones that weren't too tall yet, they could dress up and disguise themselves to look like humans. And of course, as I describe in my books, I used to see them in Las Vegas lots, quite frequently. And with their scout craft, clearly, it had the performance to take them. They used it like a car. It had the performance to take them anywhere in the world on just, a few minutes' notice. I haven't talked with them that I know of, but, like when you're in a place like Las Vegas and there's lots of people around and it's 12 o'clock at night, everybody looks a little strange,
Let's go back to the phone line. I haven't talked with them that I know of.
Okay.
All right, caller, you're live on the air. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Michelle from Quebec.
Yes, Michelle.
Good evening to you and Charles.
Good evening.
Oh, good evening.
Last time I asked you a question about the big whites there, but do they have any special, was there anything from Earth that they really craved? And was there anything they really didn't like? Like they asked to get rid of or something? Did they,
Well, the reason they're coming here to the Earth is because they need a base. Excuse me. They needed a place, a pit stop, like the same reason the U.S. Navy needs bases on the islands in the Pacific, where Navy ships can put in and, repair and refuel and refurbish and, you know, the same reason, you know, they needed, that's what they needed the Earth for when they were traveling in space. The Earth, the Sun, is at the end of what might be characterized as a chain of islands, you know, a chain of stars. And it's like in the middle of a large void in space that's like 10 light years across or so. And what they're doing is they're island hopping across that void, and the, their deep spacecraft, you know, they need to, just like any ship, they need to periodically stop and put in and repair damage and refuel and refurbish. And so what they needed from the Earth was support for the base. Like in Book 3, the opening chapter of Book 3, The Road Home, I described that night out at Range 3 when I saw the deep, their deep spacecraft, the one that came in 2 months late and carrying meteor damage. Well, they needed a place to put in and repair that, and because they breathe air and they're just like us, they couldn't have put in on the surface of Mars to repair that, because, you know, they'd have played hell repairing it, and they had lots of people on board, lots of tall white people. They needed a place like the Earth where you could put in and get the people off the craft and put into the repair shops and ask the local people for replacement sheets of titanium and electronics and other things in order to get the ship going again, because this is the same way that our astronauts would need a repair shop if we were going to a, say, like to an Earth-like planet around Bernard Star somewhere.
And yeah, you have to have some place to rescue yourself, I guess is a good way to say it. Let's go back to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, yes, this is Kevin in Iroquois Falls, Ontario. How are you doing, Kevin?
Good.
And Mr. Hall, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. It's nice talking with you.
Yes. My question is the big whites, the tall whites. Sorry. Mm-hmm. They have dealings with other governments here in Canada, like the Canadian government, like say with Pierre Trudeau or other people here in Canada, or any other politicians around the world.
As I describe in my books, when I only saw the tall whites with American Air Force generals and personnel. Now, excuse me. Now, I was an enlisted man, and they're intelligent beings. They knew that I was the schmucko on the bottom, that I wasn't running the place. And if there was any doubt in their mind, the general would prove it to them by having me do a few push-ups. And so they didn't come to tell me anything. When they came for their own purposes. And typically, the women, because they have men, as you see in my books, they have men, women, and children. The women would bring the children to play, because I'm the weather observer with pretty colored balloons that have lights on them. The kids love to come and play where I was and watch the balloons and look through my theodolites. And as long, you see, and they didn't come to tell me the secrets of the universe or anything. Frequently they would come. The adults wouldn't say anything. The kids would play. They wouldn't say anything when they came. They wouldn't say anything when they left. And the government never gave me any briefing. And so everything I learned about them, I had to learn by either thinking it through and reasoning myself or by making friends. Excuse me, after I got over the fear of them coming around, which, as you see, took like 6 months. Sorry.
Charles, let's move on to
never,
a...
They never mentioned anything like that.
Yeah, let's move on to the next caller. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, this is Bob from California.
Yes, Bob.
I just had one question for Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, the first thing I wanted to say is the other shows that you had with Kevin Smith were really good, and they're my, like, top 10 favorite.
Oh,
but,
thank you. You're very kind.
I had one question. Some people say that if there's other whatnot, that they might have, like, religion or something like that, too. What religion were those aliens? Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob.
Well, that's a really good question. Because when the tall whites came, they never came to discuss politics or anything like that with me. We never discussed religion directly. However, as you see in the books, the tall whites did have a high moral code. It was that if you didn't hurt them, they wouldn't hurt you. Or you might say the golden rule. So, for example, in book two, the night that when I was standing with my back to the front of my pickup truck, and that tall white guard approached me, and I was it was the first night that I didn't run, and I was at the time I was so afraid I could hardly move my feet, and he was saying, you know, we can kill you anytime we want. And I was really terrified. I thought he was going to do it, and then almost in desperation, I said, "But I haven't given you any reason to kill me. And anyway, you haven't killed me yet, so I don't think you're going to." And then he smiled, like, "Boy, this is a smart guy." You know, that was their religion. You know, if you didn't give them any reason to hurt you, they wouldn't. You know, if you were nice to them, they would be nice to you, and they would start out by being nice or neutral towards you. Now I know, and since then I've talked with some of my other friends from Indian Springs who, and I have some letters here from, I have a letter here from one of my friends, Terry, at Indian Springs, who, and their experiences were different than mine, but the tall whites certainly didn't, from the point of view of their religion, they didn't, if you didn't harm them, they wouldn't harm you. If you just stood there, yeah. Now, you'll see also the time when the teacher was explaining those, for example, the time when the teacher was explaining to the other tall whites what kind of person I was. She was saying, and she was using English, she was saying about me that I believe in God, I'm Roman Catholic, and that I believe that God will save, will protect me when they come around. And everyone that she was talking to understood that concept. She didn't have to explain to them what a God was or what it meant to say I believed in God, or that what it meant to say I believe that God will protect me and that I pray and stuff, that they all understood that. And that's kind of as much as I know about their religion, you know.
I have a flash message that has come in from Australia, and Rob in Australia wants to know, he says, since the release of the Millennial Hospitality series, have you been contacted by any government or military personnel?
No, I haven't. And you'll see in the books that the agreement that the generals and the tall whites had when they sent me out to the areas, you'll see as that also is true in the books. The agreement they had was that I could go anywhere I wanted in Dreamland. Dreamland was areas 53, 54, Dogbone Lake, that whole northern half of the valley. I could go there anytime I wanted, day or night. And nothing I did would ever be classified. I could tell anyone I wanted, whatever happened. The only requirement was that I had to be totally alone when I did that, that if I got in trouble when I was out there, there was no help coming, that I could take myself, I could go out there anytime I wanted, and I could come back anytime I wanted. I had the keys to all the gates. I never took anyone with me. If I ever had taken anyone with me, I wouldn't have been in any trouble. All that would have happened is they would have stopped the truck, taken whoever was that was unfortunate enough to be in the truck with me, taken them out and said, "Drive on, Mr. Hall, Airman Hall," and maybe you'd see that person again alive again, and maybe you wouldn't. You know, it just depended on, you know, because the signs out there even today say the use of lethal force is authorized, and that means they really will use lethal force if they catch you breaking the rules. And so the you know, in terms of the government, the government and the tall whites, they both take their agreements very, very seriously. And so, no, I have not been contacted by any government official or by the tall whites. That agreement is still enforced to the best of my knowledge, because the tall whites lived 700-800 years, and the agreement wasn't limited to the lifetime of my lifetime or to the lifetime of the tall whites.
Well, now that brings up a question. Do you currently have a security classification?
Yes, I have a very high one.
Uh-huh. So your release of this information has not impeded your security classification.
That's correct. It's not even mentioned. Okay. Yeah.
So that would kind of seems anyway to indicate to me that there are some people up at high levels that actually may want this information to be out there.
I agree with what you said, especially since the tall whites themselves were not in favor of secrecy. They thought they found it amusing, or they didn't really understand, for example, why we humans were terrified of them because they looked somewhat different than we do, but we humans, like we Americans, are not afraid of people from China or India, or even though they look somewhat different than, say, we Americans or Europeans, and so they thought the U.S. government should just get up and announce to the people that they were here and that they were friendly and that they wouldn't scare us, and you know, that they would dress up and look like us and that they wouldn't scare us, and that if we didn't bother them, they wouldn't bother us. And they thought they should, from their point of view, they thought it should be as easy for them to walk around Las Vegas, Nevada, as it is from anyone from India or China or you know Africa or anywhere else. The tall whites themselves, when they, the new arrivals, the ones who first come here to the earth, they are naturally more terrified of us than we are of them. And considering how terrified I was of them when I came across them, that means that they're naturally very terrified of us. From their point of view, we're built like gorillas, and this is our planet. When I was later, when I became friends with them, and I was talking with them, they expressed the view that the reason they were afraid of us is because we live here. You know, the example a teacher gave was that if I hurt myself or whatever, that I could eat any of the food, practically anything on the planet, to stay alive. I could go down and I could stop any car on the highway and ask for help, and because this is my planet. Whereas if they got in trouble, then they had to go and get one of their own people to come. And so they were naturally more afraid of us than we are of them. So they didn't really quite understand why the government thought that secrecy was necessary. Or maybe understand isn't the right word, but from their point of view, they wouldn't have kept their presence secret.
Well, you know, I can understand. If you go into the jungle, speaking about us being built like gorillas, you go into the jungle where gorillas, real gorillas, live. Yep. That's their home.
Yeah.
We have every reason to be afraid of them because they're bigger, they're stronger, they can hurt us, and we are in their home. And, you know, they are at home. And we're in an environment to which we are not fully accustomed. Yeah. And so I can see that analogy. Now, the whole secrecy thing, do they have an understanding of the fact that they are in possession of and using technology that is way beyond what most countries on this planet can even dream?
Well, they're intimately aware of that, and when they were doing technology transfer with the U.S. government, in their own words, they were not children. They could look after themselves. They were only willing to share technology with the U.S. government if it was to their advantage to do so. So, for example, they were not willing to share with the U.S. government the technology relating to the propulsion systems of the deep spacecraft. However, they were quite willing to share with the U.S. government the information relating to their radio and electronic systems, because like when that deep spacecraft put in carrying meteor damage, it was way simpler for them to go to the U.S. government and say things like, can we have like a couple of sheets of titanium and $400,000 worth of clothes for our children and ourselves, and say two off-the-shelf replacement radios and some fiber optics because we need to repair the spacecraft. You know, it was way simpler for them to just go get it from the U.S. government than to go through all the extreme difficulty of trying to bring it across, you know, 5 light years of space or 30 light years of space.
Yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. so, but some things like the propulsion system, you know, how it worked, they would ask the government for parts, but not actually say, but like for example, when the scout craft would set down and the generals would get off with the tall whites on board, the American generals, usually in groups of two or three, when they got off, they would always stand clear of the scout craft and very intentionally stand with their back to the scout craft, typically towards the front, while the tall whites got off the scout craft and went to the back where the propulsion systems were and opened up those large panels like the back of a bus has, because the tall whites were very conscious of the temperature of the coils, because the coils, you know, there were subatomic particles always, you know, they undergo a certain amount of radioactive decay, so the coils are always running hot. And
Charles, I hate to do it, we have to take a break. Let me ask the caller that I've just put on hold, are you willing to stay on hold through this break?
Yeah.
Okay, caller, just hang on. We'll get to you as soon as the break is over. We'll continue talking with Charles Hall right after this.
Get it all.
Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Call the Kevin Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
My guest is Charles Hall, and Charles, we have a caller on hold, so let's go straight to the phone line. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is David from North Carolina.
Hello, David.
Hi, Kevin. Great show.
And, thank you.
Charles Hall, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, thank you. You're very kind. Yes.
I love your story. I wish I could have experienced it as well. But I wanted to ask you: did you exchange anything with the Tall Whites? You give them something, do they give you something? Something physical or?
When I came off the ranges to go to Vietnam in May, I left for Vietnam in May of 1967, because I'm a Vietnam vet and I have an award for defending in 37 communist attacks in the Delta, as I describe in Book 3. When I came off the ranges, I came with only my memories. I didn't bring anything physical. I didn't bring any diary or any photographs or any. I was never given a briefing when I went out there, and therefore I was never given a briefing when I came off. I came off with only my memories. Now, you know, as I describe in the chapter "The Wayward Wind," which is currently in Book 4. The one thing that I do believe that of mine that the Tall Whites took was that letter that I had written to my father. I believe the doctor took that letter that I had written to my father that I describe in The Wayward Wind. I believe he took that as a souvenir. But that's the only thing that I can think of mine that I put out there for them to take. Usually what would happen is like what happened with those paint-by-number sets that I painted, the ones that do not make Vincent van Gogh feel threatened because I'm painting-by-number, but the one that was hanging on the wall of my weather shack, usually if they saw something they liked, it would disappear. But then usually it would return on schedule, in the same schedule as the deep spacecraft. So if something disappeared, it might return 2.5 months later. It might return 6 months later. It might return 9 months later. It might return 1 year later. And a few things, I'm told, had been missing for up to 2 years because the deep spacecraft came and left on schedule, just like airplanes. And so, like that paint-by-number set, I feel quite certain. And those balloons, where the teacher called me up that day and said, "Would it be okay if she took a balloon because the children found them interesting?" And then that was returned. See,
Now that was weather balloons, right?
That's correct. I feel quite certain that that when they took something, that they put it on the deep spacecraft to take down wherever that was going to show it to people, but they were very conscientious about returning it. You know, that was one of the agreements they had, as we describe in Wayward Wind, that they had, that tour guide was explaining to the doctor, that the agreement they'd made with the U.S. government was that they would never, that if they took something of mine, they would never take it to a place where I couldn't come and get it, and you know that it was okay with the generals if they say took my ruler and left it for me to find out by my theodolite stand, and that happened sometimes. But they would never. Stuff wouldn't just walk off, or if they did take it, it would always be returned. And so you know, when I came off the ranges, you know, even that bottle, even that milk bottle, and or even that bottle that was used as the marker up on the slope of Area 53, the one that was marked Tonopah Dairy 1908 and had this beautiful purple color, and of course Tonopah didn't have a dairy till 1928. that even that I returned to where it came to that same place in the hill where it had been before.
Well, let me ask you a question. Now, you mentioned the kids, the children taking wanting to take a balloon, and the teacher asked you, "Can we have a balloon?"
The teacher was the one that wanted to take the balloon to show to the kids on another that weren't here on the earth.
Okay, but the question is, what about the kids? Did they act like children act here on earth?
No, the children. I never saw a child intentionally disobey its parent. The bond between the mother and the child, the mother, as I describe in my books, when the mother came with the children never questioned the parent's decision. And if the mother said something to the child obeyed immediately. There was none of this. It wasn't like, say, my wife and I, we raised, our six, five children, and my wife had like if I took my son to the park and he was playing and I wanted him to come home, where he might say, "Oh, Father, I'm having fun. Can I play longer?" And then if you said no, we have to go now, where he might, when he was like two, he might throw a tantrum. Their children weren't like that at all. When the mothers took them somewhere, or their fathers, when they were with somebody, the parents would, as I describe in book two, in the chapter, the fathers would break, they'd broken every rule that you can imagine just so their children could have fun. But in return, the children would never question their parents or their fathers, or their mothers. If their parents said, "Now it's time to go," the kids just packed up and went. There was no backtalk.
Well, let's take that to adulthood. Did you ever see any of the adult tall whites argue with each other?
Not at all like humans. That's why in book three, in the day that I describe the end of innocence, when Pamela, had the weapon set to the wrong setting and fired on me, and the teacher grabbed it out of her hand. That's why that was so unique, because that was like practically the only time that I ever saw one of the tall whites do that. But the tall whites never fought with each other. If they had a discussion, it was like the discussion between tour guide and the doctor, where the tour guide wanted to take the letter as a souvenir, and tour guide wasn't sure that it was allowed by the agreement that they had with the U.S. generals. That wasn't a heated argument. They never engaged in heated arguments. Now, what they did back when they were by themselves, I have no idea. But from the ones that I saw, I never saw any evidence of bad feeling between any two tall whites or between any parents or children. I never saw any tall white say anything, derogatory or not friendly with any of the other tall whites. I know that they had difference of opinions, because like the captain, he was a nice guy, but he, from his point of view, it would be perfectly okay with him if he never had anything to do with humans. He didn't really hate humans, he didn't really like humans. If you told him to go and tell Charlie something, well, he'd go and tell Charlie something. But, he really didn't, if you gave him his choice, you'd never see him. On the other hand, the school bus driver and the mechanic, they were surprisingly friendly. And when they would come around as guards with new arrivals, you might talk with them the same way that you might talk, almost the way you would talk with a human. The tall white men weren't anywhere near as conversational as corresponding human men would be. The tall white women were a lot more conversational, so usually if they came around as a group, it'd be a woman that you'd be talking to. Although Range 4 Harry, although he was more conversational than most tall whites, but even he was, you'd normally describe as the silent type. I mean, if he didn't have anything to say, he wouldn't say anything. And that meant that if he had no reason to say hello, he wouldn't say hello. He might just walk in and stand there and watch you and then walk out,
Now, so, I have a question that I don't think I asked in previous shows. If I did, I apologize, but I've been thinking about this, and I don't think I asked it. But did you ever observe what they eat?
Yes, they're plant eaters. And one of the facilities out there, which I don't describe in my books, is where they prepare the food that the U.S. government provides them, and also that they bring themselves on the deep spacecraft. As I describe in book three, one of the days that I was on the scout craft, I was looking in those overhead compartments, and what they had in there was a pudding kind of thing that the teacher had made for the children. And it could have been like tapioca pudding or mushroom pudding. She was very proud of the fact that she'd made it. And adults could eat it, although she'd actually made it so that for the children to eat when they were out and about. And she had packaged it herself in those sealed plastic bags, using stuff that the U.S. government had simply given to them.
Did you ever taste any of this?
No, I didn't. And one time when we were talking about that, it was my I'm paraphrasing what the teacher said.
Oh, you know what, Charles? I just looked at the clock, and a break is about to hit us.
Let's
leave the audience in suspense here just a little bit. And okay. I want to hear about that. I want to hear about a little bit more about their food and
what kind of plants did they eat, and is it possible that whatever it is they eat would extend our lives if we were to adopt that diet? Would it be healthier for us, or is it something peculiar and particular to their physiology, which although is very much like us, there are differences? We'll be back right after this.
Light, bust the night, and I'm walking
get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Call the Kevin Smith Show at 1-800-289-1092.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking this evening with Charles Hall. And Charles, we have a caller online, and let me just say to the caller, hang on, we'll get to you in just a second. We are on final approach. That means we've got about 15 minutes left or so. And if you're going to call, you must do so soon, because we're running out of time.
Charles, what about the food? Was offered to you?
No. When I was talking with the teacher, it was clear they were plant eaters. The tall whites do not have teeth the way we do, or the way the Norwegians with 24 teeth do. They have ridges, and they're plant eaters. And some of my friends, who are the range maintenance people called the range rats, they saw them gathering, they told me that they saw them gathering grass seeds and seeds from wild plants over on French Peak in the fall and used them to flavor or season their foods. And which was consistent with the food that I saw that the teacher made. The tall white women were very proud of their ability to take care of their children and do food preparation. However, when I talked to the teacher about it, she told me that it wasn't a good idea for a human to eat their food, because some of their foods you could eat, but she said that on their planet there were three different kinds of chemicals that typically are found in their food and that in their plants, because their planet is larger than the Earth and runs hotter than the Earth. And she said that they don't kill you or anything. It's just that it takes your body a while to get used to it. The one that's the biggest problem is that if you eat it, say if you eat some of their food and it has that chemical in it, it'll take your body anywhere from 2.5. There's one that takes your body 2.5 years to adjust to, and during that 2.5 years, you're not really drunk, but you know how you feel, like if you've had a couple of beers and you feel real high and you feel really irresponsible and you just want to go off and kind of like play or, you know, let the world go by. And it takes your body about 2.5 years to get over that. There's one that takes about 5 years to get over, and there's a lesser one that takes about 7 years for your body to get over. When a human is around them, it's not a good idea for a human to ever eat any of the food that they have prepared, you know.
Yeah, it wouldn't be cool.
Yeah.
All right.
But you have to know exactly what you're doing before you do that. So, no, I never tasted their food.
All right, let's go back to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Okay, well, that's exactly what I was afraid would happen, because I answered that call 10 seconds before the commercial break was over. It happens every time if I answer during a commercial break. I will discipline myself and not answer any calls during commercial breaks from this point forward forever and ever. Amen. All right. If you're going to call, now is the time. 1-800-289-1092. 1-800-289-1092. Toll free. And you've got about 1 minute, a 1 minute window to get your call in. Charles, the new book,
yeah,
Millennial Hospitality 4,
uh-huh,
is not presented in the format of a novel. It's just you telling us the story, and real place names are used.
Yeah.
You reveal some new stuff. Pick one new thing, and if you don't mind, and share it with us. We've only got 5 minutes left.
In book four, one, I have answers to frequently asked questions, and I also have a section on where I attempt to cover letters and stuff that people have sent us. Recent developments and stuff. Stories that some of the fans have sent me that I think are credible. I call that section "Credible Updates." Of people who, my readers who believe they've seen tall whites or whatever, and one that isn't in the book but is the letter that I received from my friend at Indian Springs, Terry, who was there for 4 years, and he was there from 64 through 67, and he remembers me, and he also remembers, we had many mutual friends. And I won't read his whole letter, because I know we're short of time. But he was in this nice letter that he sent me. He said that reading his book was that he really enjoyed my book. He said, "I've listened to your radio shows, and everything." And he says it really, reawakened his memories of the times when he was out there. He said, "I quote, I'm recalling some of my experiences and things that I saw that were hard to actually believe that I actually saw." Those were his words. I feel better now that I know that I wasn't alone, and in his words, nuts or drunk. And I had a substantial number of letters like that, similar letters from readers who, and those are in my book four as well, Incredible Updates. I also tried to explain, describe in maintaining the emotion and in the same easy reading format, what it was like in when I first went to Indian Springs, some of the real early experiences with the tall whites, because I know a lot of readers have asked about that, and I tried to maintain that same to capture how I felt when those things were happening to mm-hmm. me and now, convey it to the reader so that they could feel those same things.
I don't know if I've ever told you this. I think I have. In fact, I think when I talked with you, remember when we were in Sholo, when I met you in Sholo, Arizona?
Yes, I remember well.
And at breakfast the next morning, we were in the dining room there and we were talking. I think that I shared this with you then, but I'm not absolutely sure. The first time I heard of Indian Springs was when a friend of mine, an acquaintance, more than an acquaintance, a friend, a retired Air Force person, asked me if I had ever heard of Indian Springs, and I said no. And he said, "Well, you need to do some checking on Indian Springs and see if you can find someone that will talk to you about it. It would make a great show." And something like a couple of months after that is when you and I first came across each other and we had you on the show. So there are other people out there in the Air Force that know something is really strange out at Indian Springs. We've only got 1 minute until we have to close the show. I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about how we can get your books. Also, if you have any upcoming events, if you can do that in a minute, go for it.
Yes, thank you for having me on your show. I always enjoy being on your show. And I will be giving that speed at book signing at Borders Express in Mays Landing, New Jersey, which is just a few miles out of Atlantic City, and the evening of April 18th, this coming April 18th. And you can, and my books are sold, you can ask for my books at any bookstore. They're sold all over the world. They're sold through Amazon.com. You can get them off the web. You can also get them off from my, the links off from my website at www.millennialhospitality.com.
All right, I'm afraid we're out of time. Charles, hang on the line with me for just a second. Ladies and gentlemen, my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. I'll be back tomorrow night. You be here, too. Until then, so long, everybody.